Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday. And we're happy to have Bill Moyers with us, who's written a marvelous book on democracy. Bill Moyers has a long and illustrious career in the press and also in the world of politics. Founding organizer of the Peace Corps, he has a great story to tell about John F. Kennedy asking him to join the government. He was senior White House assistant and press secretary to President Lyndon Johnson, publisher of Newsday, senior news analyst for CBS News, producer of many public TV series. He hosts one now. He's the winner of more than 30 Emmy Awards and 9 Peabody Awards. His best-selling books include Listening to America, A World of Ideas, The Power of Myth with Joseph Campbell, and Moyers on America. He serves as the pro bono president of the Schuman Center for Media and Democracy. And he talks about the fact that we've fallen under the spells of money, faction, and fear in this country. The great American experience in creating a different future together has been subjugated to individual cunning in the pursuit of wealth and power, and to the claims of empire with its ravenous demands and stuporous distractions. A sense of political impotence pervades the country. Perhaps that's changing, because he looks at the bad and he looks at the possible good. I love Studs Terkel's recommendation of this book. Bill Moyers has been my North Star in his eloquence, his quiet passion and courage, and in the way he presents me and millions of others with the ideals of our nation, from our past to our present to our uncertain future. Always he offers the gifts of thoughtfulness and also of hope. Hello, Bill Moyers. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure, Kathleen. I'm delighted you asked me.
I can't believe that graduation speech at Hamilton College. I think you ought to do that full time. I read that last night as I was sitting in front of my son's school picking him up from baseball practice, and it just brought tears to my eyes. How come? Because of the amazing challenges that you spoke the truth to these young people of how, you know, we're sorry we've left you with this mess, but also what you can do to make it better. It was just honest and challenging, and it was the truth. It was good.
Well, I believe this generation of young people wants to embrace the truth. They expect journalists like me to describe the world as I see it, without rosy scenarios or without illusions or without sunglasses. Mm-hmm. I was on Jon Stewart the other night, and Jon Stewart said to me, you know, my audience, and he has a large audience of young people, likes to have you come on the show because they believe you do want us to know what the world is really like, but they also don't believe you wring your hands in despair over the realities they face. And they do face, as I said in that speech, Kathleen, some mm-hmm. very, very big challenges.
Yeah, one of the biggest is the Earth, right?
That's right. I mean, the fact of the matter is, there's a new book by Gus Speth, who was for many years the dean of the environmental school at Yale, and he just lays it out, saying beyond Al Gore, saying that that we are consuming our resources at such a rate and showing so little signs of abating and tempering our appetites for the world's resources, that they're going to be exhausted just as the population is expanding.
Mm-hmm. Tell me one of the stories of hope. I'm always interested in people's families, and I didn't really know the background of your dad, who didn't have much education, who loved FDR. And here you are working in the White House, and your dad came to the White House. It's just a lovely story.
And he asked if he could see. His first choice was to see the Roosevelt Room. It used to be called the Fish Room because they had a big fish hung up on the wall there, but the name was changed to the Roosevelt Room. My father, who had a fourth grade education, had to leave school because the family needed him to go out in the field and pick cotton. Mm. And my mother and he, when they were married, were picking cotton in West Texas. But my father believed every time he heard Franklin Roosevelt talk on the radio, was talking directly to him. My father said, you know, he's my friend. And Franklin Roosevelt never knew my father. No politician ever paid my father much heed. Mm-hmm. But the way Roosevelt spoke about the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, the way Roosevelt talked about how government by money is just as dangerous as government by the mob, the way he talked about opportunity and the four freedoms, struck a chord in this this cotton farmer down in Oklahoma. And my father's hero was Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Hmm. One of yours.
Now, there are a lot of stories of hope. You know, I do. My mother had an eighth grade education, but to the very end, she was watching public television, listening to public radio. She had an insatiable curiosity about the world. She believed that even though, I mean, here's a woman who lived through World War I, the Great Depression, World War II, the Cold War, Vietnam,
goodness,
Watergate. And yet she never lost her faith that this country could do the right thing when ultimately challenged.
Yeah. I saw you on, I don't know, one of those cable shows I watch too much of, I guess, in this political time. But you were talking about, with Keith Olbermann, I think, about the number of people who own the wealth in this country and the people who have no net worth, which seems to me is a huge problem, which contributes to a lack of hope. And how did we reach a point where 10% of the population have 60% of the wealth?
Because 25 years ago, the political scene came to be dominated by ideologues who believed unquestioningly in the market, that the market would solve all of our problems. We had the Reagan Revolution, which said government is the problem, and began to cut those functions of the government that are supposed to serve all of us. And because we had the dot-com bubble and the SNL bubble and all of that, the sad thing is that the great American wealth machine was put to work enriching the people at the top with little regard for the people at the bottom. I mean, for people who have it, America's the Midas touch. Everything turns to gold. Mm-hmm. But for millions of people, the American dream has simply been either out of reach or slipping through their hands. Kathleen, the income gap between rich and poor in this country is greater than it's been since 1929. And not just the poor at the bottom, but working people. Many of them, you know, I spent 8 years coming back and forth to Milwaukee following the fortunes of two couples in Milwaukee, an African-American couple and a white couple, who had been laid off in the late 90s by one of your manufacturing companies there that had moved south. And we tracked them for a series that became known, one of my favorite and best series of all time on PBS, called Surviving the Good Times, about what happens to people who've had good manufacturing jobs and who then begin, they're laid off, their jobs disappear, they have to fall down the ladder, they have to work at two jobs, their children have to go to work. That's a story that's repeated all over the country today. And, Oscar Wilde once said that the mark of a truly educated person is to be deeply moved by statistics. That is, to see the human reality behind the numbers. When I went to, you talk about my being in politics with John F. Kennedy, when I went to Washington in 1960, the gap between the top 20% and the bottom 20% was 30-fold. It's now 75-fold.
Goodness.
Yeah, and you, the American Political Science Association a few years ago concluded that privileged Americans roar with a clarity and consistency that the politicians hear and follow, but that most citizens with lower or moderate incomes speak with a whisper. Mm-hmm. And about that same time, The Economist of London, which is no socialist rag, it's the great business journal of our time, The Economist says the United States risks calcifying into a European-style, class-based society in which upward mobility becomes harder and harder to achieve. That's my great concern about America's future.
Yeah. Do you think that's going to change? Do you think that's one of the themes of what's going on politically right now?
I'm very encouraged by the large turnout in the Democratic primary. This race is a fascinating one.
Yes, it is.
And I think both the people supporting Hillary Clinton and the people supporting Barack Obama, particularly the young people, but the working people who seem to be behind her, are eager. They want some changes. They want fundamental change. You know, we never lose sight in America of the possibilities of the promise of this country. And every now and then, like 1960 and again in 80 with Reagan giving a voice to all of the conservatives who had not been a part of the power structure for so long, there's almost a a volcano of hope that's coming out all at once here in this campaign, and I find that very encouraging.
Tell us the story. I love this story of when John Kennedy wanted you to be in his administration, and you said, "No, no, no, I got to go to graduate school." And here he wants you to really organize the whole Peace Corps, to be the founding organizer of the whole Peace Corps. You're a young kid. Everybody says you're too young. It's a wonderful story.
Well, I was doing my graduate work at that time, and I'd taken off before going on to complete my graduate work to work for Lyndon Johnson, with whom I'd been an intern many years ago in 1954. And in 1960, when Lyndon Johnson decided to run for president for the Democratic nomination, he asked me to come and be his boy Friday, let's put it that way. And I did. I suspended my graduate school, and then during the campaign, he didn't get the nomination, but he was asked by Kennedy to be the vice presidential nominee. And as I say in the book, Kennedy, excuse me, I'm sorry, I'm running out of water here. And Kennedy, then they won the election, and I was going back to graduate school. But during the campaign, I had been the liaison between the two campaigns, the two airplanes, Johnson on one, Kennedy on the other. And I had, since I was from Texas, but the folks from Boston understood what I was saying, and vice versa, I'd become sort of an important nexus between the two. And so, but as I was preparing to, John Kennedy came down to the LBJ Ranch after the election, and I was saying goodbye, and he said, "Wait a minute, you can't go back to graduate school." And I said, "Well, look, why?" And he said, "Because I need you in the administration." And I said, "Look, you don't need another Baptist preacher. I was studying to teach theology." And he said, "Don't you know that the president of Harvard, the founder of Harvard, was a Baptist? I need you back. I need another Baptist in Washington." And that's how I went. I didn't organize the Peace Corps. His brother-in-law, Sergeant Shriver, was put in charge by Kennedy of organizing the Peace Corps. But Shriver asked me to join him, and I did. Became one of the founding directors, and then its first deputy director.
Yeah. And who went to bat for you? Because there was some opposition. I think you were 28, and somebody reminded people, no, you were 28 and a half. Who went to bat
for you? Well, when I was nominated to be vice president, to be a deputy director of the Peace Corps, that requires Senate confirmation. So I was in my hearings up in the Senate, and a very conservative Democrat from Ohio was questioning my credentials, my qualifications to be in the number two position at the Peace Corps. And he asked me, you know, "How old are you?" And I said, he said, "You're only 28. And I said, "No, I'm 28 and a half. Well, the committee passed me. He was opposed to it, and he was going to speak on the floor against me. And Senator Hubert Humphrey, who was not yet vice president, he would become vice president under LBJ in 1964, Senator Hubert Humphrey came to the floor of the Senate and made an impassioned speech about the role of young people in American history. And he started with Thomas Jefferson, you know, who was 20-something when he wrote the Declaration of Independence, and came on talking about how when he was only 30-something, Hubert Humphrey had been elected mayor of Minneapolis. I mean, it was a stirring speech. I would have voted for myself after listening to Hubert Humphrey. And I got the nomination. And that was the story. Hubert Humphrey became a mentor. He became a close advisor to mine and a good friend. And one of the best speeches in the book, one of the best essays in the book, Moyers on Democracy, is the one I made in 1998 on the 50th anniversary of Hubert Humphrey's famous speech at the Philadelphia Democratic Convention, when he talked about leading the Democratic Party and the country out of the shadows into the sunlight of civil rights.
And that was back in 1948 he gave that. I don't think people remember that speech. They will now because your book, but...
Right.
Yeah. He was. Now, there. Talk about optimism in times of great despair, the happy warrior. This man was an optimistic man, wasn't he?
He was. He loved politics. He was criticized in the 1968 election when he ran against Nixon and almost won. He lost by something like 600,000, 700,000 votes. But he was criticized for being the happy warrior, as you say. It was a time when the cities had been burning. There were demonstrations. Chicago erupted at the Democratic National Convention. The Vietnam War was raging. There was so much pain and hurt in the country. But Hubert Humphrey, by nature, coming from the Midwest there, coming from the Great Plains and the Northern Plains, he just, you know, he had a belief in America that was as broad as that horizon. And he couldn't help but being resilient and euphoric and optimistic. That was just his nature. He was a great believer, having, by the way, having come from austere circumstances himself in the small towns of the Midwest. But he was a great believer in the promise of America, and in our capacity as a people. I remember he told me a story once about how at the end of her career, Helen Keller was speaking at a small Midwestern college. Helen Keller, for the benefit of your audiences, was born a blind as a child. She overcame her blindness to become a great educator, writer, and example to America, a wonderful hero of America in her life. And a student asked her, "Miss Keller, is there anything that could have been worse than losing your sight?" And Helen Keller replied, "Yes, I could have lost my vision." Mm-hmm. And Hubert Humphrey said, "You know, we must never lose our vision." What is that vision? Well, I write about this in the book, Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, which has been nurtured in a framework of government of, by, and for the people. Mm-hmm. And the challenge to us today is, can we take our government back and put it to work for the benefits of all people and not just the people at the top?
Bill Moyer is our guest. We're going to welcome phone calls for him. His book is On Democracy, and it's a collection of speeches that he's given at wonderful occasions all over the country and thoughts about what he was thinking when he put the speeches together. They're truly marvelous pieces of writing, and so we're talking about a lot of issues this hour and welcoming your calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. He says at one point early in the book, if he were to choose a theme song for the concerns that are in this book, it would be Arlo Guthrie's Patriot's Dream. So we're going to play just a tad bit of that before we start taking your calls. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Living now, here but for fortune, placed by fate's mysterious schemes. That we're the ones asked to try to rekindle the patriot's dreams. Arise, sweet destiny, time runs short. All of your patience has heard their retort. Hear us now, for alone we can't seem to try to rekindle the patriot's dream.
Arlo Guthrie in The Patriot's Dream, just a portion of it. Bill Moyers writes in his book, if he were to choose a theme song for the concerns in this book, it would be Arlo Guthrie's Patriot's Dream. Why do you say that, Bill?
First of all, that song moves me because it articulates a faith in our effort as a people to turn our fortunes and our fate around. Second, you know, I'm often criticized by right-wingers in particular for being that they say that because I criticize the administration, I'm criticizing the country. I'm an American hater or a Bush basher, they say. Mm-hmm. You know, that is so misplaced, because if you really love your country, you're going to speak truth to the people who run it. if we confuse the government with the country, we're making a tragic misperception. Hmm. The government is bigger than the country. The country is bigger than the government. The government is bigger than the administration. And in fact, it is our capacity under the First Amendment as a people to challenge authority that has been the saving grace in our history. If it weren't for the dissenters, we wouldn't have had the independence. We'd be living under Queen Elizabeth today. If it weren't for women who stood up for their rights, you wouldn't have the vote today. If it weren't for men who were willing to die to free the slaves, we wouldn't have had equality today. Right on through, dissent is the way, well, put it this way. Suppose the passengers on the Titanic had seen the iceberg that the captain ignored, and they had climbed up on the bridge of the ship, grabbed the captain by the arm, and said, "That's an iceberg out there. Let's turn course." That's what we have to do in this country. When our presidents and our governments, our state legislators, are leading us astray, it's our right and obligation to stand up and say, "You're wrong." Because you love your country, because you love your state, because you love your city, not because you hate. And that's what we have, that's what the right-wing ranters have achieved over the last 25 years, by making it seem that anybody exercising the right to criticize their administration it loathes their country. I mean, when they were criticizing Democrats and liberals in power, they were exercising their First Amendment. Right. Nobody said they hated America. But now when you criticize the Bush administration or Vice President Cheney or the Republican-led Congress for so long, under Newt Gingrich and others, they effectively turned your dissent into a partisan issue rather than a patriotic issue. So when I listen to Arlo Guthrie sing "The Patriot's Dream," I'm reminded that the true patriot is the one who says, like Paul Revere, "The British are coming, the British are coming," and then takes up his musket and heads for the Concord Bridge to stand up for independence. Hmm.
Let's go to some phone calls. Kay is our first caller. Hi, Kay.
Hi. It's so nice to be on the program. I just wanted to say to Bill Moyers that I think in times like this, when so many of us are struggling to have hope, watching you on your journal every Friday night and the writings, and just to me, you are the epitome of truth and journalism. And I also wanted to say that back in 1980, I was on a documentary with you. I was the nurse that took care of Kathy Dixon's child in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Is that right?
Yes, the nurse that took care of her and people like us. And I still am a member at St. Benedict's Church. Kathy has, as you probably know, died a couple of years.
Yes, I knew that.
But I am.
Oh, and I'm so glad to hear from you.
And you know, I think the fact that you did what you did, Bill, in Milwaukee, and came into Kathy Dixon's home. Kathy Dixon, for the listeners, was a poor black woman, very poor, who had a very sick child and was in going to lose her Medicaid. She did lose her Medicaid, which paid me as the nurse to come in and take care of her. This was the beginning during the Reagan era when all of this bad, horrible, uncivil nastiness began to start. And I think that gave Kathy, an extra surge of hope. Kathy was a very strong woman. She fought for the rights of her child. She didn't have a high school education, but I'll tell you, Kathy knew. Kathy knew what was going on in the government because it was happening to her every single day when she couldn't make her 50-cent copay at the door for medicine.
Right, and that documentary, I did that documentary for CBS Reports. I was the senior correspondent then. Very powerful documentary done with a marvelous team, and Kathy was a very important figure in it. We were looking at what was happening to people who were falling through the safety net as the Reagan administration began to let that safety net slip. Do you know, Kay, that somehow the Reagan White House got an advance copy of that documentary, and they released before it aired a barrage of disinformation about it, trying to discredit the documentary even before it aired.
Oh my.
To this day, I can get apoplectic about mainstream corporate journalism because somebody inside our news organization leaked the transcript of that broadcast to the White House before the documentary aired.
Oh my. Kay, thank you so much for calling. I'm glad you called. And there is one, if not
she's two. One of the reasons, by the, you know, you ask me, am I hopeful? I'm always hopeful, right, because there are people like, right, her, and there are millions like that.
Yes, there are. Yes, there are. You write about they're going after you as well. I mean, trying to get you off the air. Bill Moyers, big threat to what? Who are you a threat to?
I don't know. The right wing in this country has realized that the progressive message is a powerful tradition in American life, and they've been able to drown it out because corporate media doesn't do justice to the progressive tradition in this country, the tradition that advocates for ordinary working people, the you know, John Q. Public, and so, but they could not defeat the message, so they had to discredit the messenger. So if you try to tell the story of a woman on welfare in Milwaukee, or a working class family, two working class families in Milwaukee, like I did in the series "Surviving the Good Times" or "Living on the Edge" was a subtitle for it. They don't go after Kathy Dixon or the two families in Milwaukee. They come after the messenger. They try to discredit the person who's telling their story.
Mm-hmm.
And so when a right winger was appointed chairman by George W. Bush of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which is supposed to be the heat shield between politicians and public broadcasting, and he began to implement the White House's strategy to stifle any dissenting or alternative voices on public broadcasting, the straw that broke the camel back, he later told the Washington Post, was watching a documentary I did on Now with Bill Moyers then, which is 5 years ago, a documentary about what was happening to working people in the small town of Tamaqua, Pennsylvania, when their jobs, like the jobs that had been moved out of Milwaukee, were moved south and to Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, this is very critical of NAFTA and NAFTA's consequences on working people. This fellow, who was then chairman of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, mounted a private, secret campaign to try to discredit me, because he said he thought that documentary wasn't what was liberal. And my answer to that was, if it's liberal to tell the story of what's happening to working people in,
mm-hmm,
this country,
mm-hmm,
and to say why isn't their government responding to their needs, then I'm a liberal,
mm-hmm.
You know. But he subsequently, for reasons of his own inadequacies and because his own inspector general at the Corporation for Public Broadcasting issued a report about his irregularities in office, he left. He was then subsequently had to leave another board he was on, to which Bush had appointed him. It's just a typical story of what's happened in this,
right,
administration,
right,
of one ideologue after another trying to turn government to the purposes of partisan politics.
And then going on places like Fox News to make his point. Of course, they don't have any ideological bias, do they?
No, you put your finger on two of my favorite chapters in the book. One of those speeches I made, in fact, Kathleen, when I came out to speak to the very first conference of the very first media reform conference,
mm-hmm,
which was held in Madison, Wisconsin, 4 years ago, a group of citizens concerned about the corporate domination of our media have organized what's called now Free Press. You can go to freepress.net, and I've spoken at every one of their conferences for the last 4 years, and one of the speeches turned into a chapter of the book is based on my response. Two of the speeches are based on my response to the efforts in Washington to subvert public broadcasting.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email concerning newspapers. You've occasionally, Bill, spoken to the sorry or sordid state of American journalism, especially the desperate plight of newspapers. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel faces an uncertain future. Madison's Cap Times basically no longer exists. Newspapers are confronted by impossible financial and corporate pressures. Speak further to this reality. Is there anything you can envision that might revive the newspaper industry that seems so essential to digging up and disseminating information? Aren't we in jeopardy if the newspaper and genuine broadcast news journalism is jeopardized?
Absolutely. The quality of journalism is directly related to the quality of democracy, and I'm a great believer in newspapers. I started at the age of 16 on the Marshall News Messenger, the daily newspaper in the little town of East Texas. By the way, a week from Friday night, Bill Moyers' Journal will feature a report, an investigative report done by the Milwaukee paper, by some very dedicated reporters at the paper who were wondering why the Federal Drug Administration had been so slow about, and the Environmental Protection Agency had been so slow in investigating the potential harm in a particular chemical. It's an excellent report that the Milwaukee Sentinel did last year. There's an update to it, and we're featuring it on Bill Moyer's Journal a week from Friday night.
Great.
There are several reasons why newspapers are in trouble. One, of course, is the rise of broadcasting, and then the rise of the Internet has provided competition and an alternative to newspapers that has challenged them. The second is that bad management. That a lot of our newspaper owners have just been negligent. They've just been living a they have the golden touch. I mean, newspaper, the margin of profit on the rate of return on newspapers is higher than most industries in this country. And greedy owners have not been satisfied with 20% return on the investment. They've wanted 25 or 30%. And so they keep cutting the news whole, diminishing the amount of space given to news, cutting the journalists because it takes time to report stories, and they've dug themselves into this hole. Newspapers in Europe, newspapers in Japan, other places in other countries are flourishing because they're not as greedy as American owners are for the returns on their profits. And also, our newspaper publishers are not very imaginative. I don't want to overgeneralize. Some are, but many of them have just been living with a cash cow and not attending to the obligation of the newspaper to tell people there in Milwaukee or Minneapolis or elsewhere what's going on in their communities. It's a lack of leadership.
Jim is our next caller from Hollandale. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. Kathleen, I'm really glad you're back, and I hope you're doing well.
Thanks, Jim. I am.
Good. Bill, and I want to say to you, you're one of the lone voices in the wilderness, and I've been following you for years.
And thank you, sir.
I would like to ask you, in view of all of what you said so far and what other people have said too, would you or could you make any kind of recommendation what ordinary people could do to reverse this process? I mean, I'm one of the reluctantly forced off our dairy farms, Wisconsin dairy farmers, and I've been active in the Wisconsin Democratic Party for most of my adult life and on the Platform Resolutions Committee, and I just wondered what you might recommend to ordinary people that we could do to reverse this process.
There's no formula. I appreciate what you say, by the way, and I like to think that I've produced my journalism over the years for people like you, people for whom the American dream has been put on hold, the people who don't have a voice anymore in with our two parties. There is no easy formula, Jim, that I wish I could wave a wand and say this is what one can do. It's a long, slow fight, because the only answer to organized money, which runs the country today, is organized people. Organization is difficult for people who are having to work long hours or holding two jobs, but it is the only thing that over time can turn one of the parties or both of the parties around and force them to confront the realities of our life today and to put the interest of the country ahead of the interest of power. The progressives out there in the Midwest taught us how to do this in the 1890s and the early 1900s. The Democratic Farmers Labor Party in Minneapolis grew up from the grassroots, from people who were mad as hell and weren't going to take it anymore. The only answer I know is that after you cast your vote in November, and that's an obligation we all have, but it's not the ultimate solution, the ultimate answer, because we've made the president into a kind of demigod, and we think the president, whomever we elect, is going to solve what can only be solved actually by the muscle of people. It is then to find one or two local organizations that network with others and get involved in the long, slow organizing at the precinct level, at the whether it's your environmental group or whether it's your dairy group, you're not any longer a dairy farmer, whatever it is, politics really is local, and it takes staying power to stick with it. I don't expect, no matter who's elected president in November, I don't expect quick solutions to the basic fundamental issues I write about in Warriors on Democracy. The fact that politics can create problems it then doesn't solve because it tries to solve them from the top down in Washington. We start a war and we can't end it. Our infrastructure is collapsing, but so what? We need to spend $252 billion a year repairing our highways, our roads, our bridges, our sewer systems, our water systems. We have to get involved wherever with other people of like minds, kindred spirits, we think we might have an effect. I saw a story about a small town in Washington the other day, state of Washington, where the local people got together to defeat an effort by the city government to privatize their water and sewer system. Mm. Now, it's a small victory, but an important victory. And it's really rebuilding a constituency of people around the country mm-hmm. that will take a lot of time. I wish it were easier than that, but it isn't going to be.
You include at some point in the book the Marge Piercy poem. I can't remember the name of the power of one and then the power of 10 million. It's a great poem.
That's the Marge Piercy I had on a series I did a few years ago about poetry. I love, you know, I don't just live in the world of politics. I'm not obsessed with politics. I know politics is the way we solve our collective problems. But I love poetry. I love writers. I Marge Piercy was on, and she has this marvelous poem, which I quoted at the end of last year's Media Reform Conference mm-hmm. held in Memphis on the anniversary of Martin Luther King's assassination. And I said, if you stand up at the local level, challenge the powers that be, speak truth to power, they're going to come after you. They are. But you have to remember Marge Piercy's poem. I don't have the book in front of me, Kathleen, but it's a great inspiring poem for people who, like Jim just said, believe things are that we're in trouble in this country and want to be a part of turning it around.
Yeah. Thanks, Jim, very much for the call. We pause for just a moment and return. Bill Moyers is our guest. He is author of Moyers on Democracy, just released. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Our lines, we have one line open if you'd like to join us, 800-486-8655. Milwaukee area callers, 414-227-2050. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Bill Moyers, our guest. We go to Ed from West Allis. Hi, Ed.
Well, when I'm on this program, I normally talk about labor issues. I guess if I had a song to encapsulate this era, it would be the old Wobbly Doxology, Praise Boss When Morning Work Bells Chime. And I'm looking at a pamphlet from 1995, the heady days of 1995, when we were at 11.1% of the workforce organized labor. A New Voice for American Workers, Rebuilding the American Labor Movement, by John Sweeney, Richard Trumka, and Linda Chavez-Thompson. But since we have you, Mr. Moyers, and since all of our lives were so directly changed by the assassination of John F. Kennedy on November 22, 1963, and realizing that the last major speech that he gave was to the AFL-CIO exactly 168 hours before his death in Madison Square Garden on November 15th, 1963. Who killed John F. Kennedy?
Problem answering that question. I believe that Lee Harvey Oswald killed John F. Kennedy. I know all of the other suggestions and all the other theories, and I've looked at it seriously in my own life because I too, I was in Texas at the time, came back to Washington with Lyndon Johnson and the coffin of John F. Kennedy, whom I also loved on that plane, and I looked very hard at the work of the Warren Commission. I've read the book since then, and I'm persuaded. I'm convinced. I don't have any doubt about the fact that I believe Lee Harvey Oswald killed John F. Kennedy, just like James Earl Ray killed Martin Luther King. I know all of the seemingly rational evidence that adds up to conspiracy theories, but I don't believe them. I didn't know, by the way, that JFK had spoken at the labor convention that week before. I do want to say that also on Bill Moyers Journal, a week from Friday night, the same night I run the investigative report of the Milwaukee reporters. I'm also doing a piece about what it means to people that they've lost strong unions representing them. Mm. And I want to combine what this caller just said with what Jim said. You know, if there's one thing I think most of us should commit ourselves to, it would be to the goal of breaking the monopoly that big money has over American politics. And there is a way to do it. It's called public funding. Mm-hmm. Immediately the right wing is going to say, oh, no, welfare for the politicians. No, it would take us $10 a year to fund our federal elections if we wanted to do it. And states like Maine and Arizona have shown that public funding of state elections means that teachers can run, union members can run, shopkeepers can run, housewives can run, house husbands can run, without having to bend their knee to the big donors. This is a long-term solution, but it's the most realistic solution I see on the horizon for breaking the monopoly that big money has over our politics. And if I may just say one thing on this issue, this is not just a liberal issue, by the way, Kathleen and your listeners. Just by chance last night, I was reading a magazine. I read a lot of magazines, and I read the American Conservative and National Review and other conservative magazines, so I know what they're saying. Mm-hmm. Let me read you what I read last night in the American Conservative, which is a very conservative magazine. The article begins by talking about the political lobby that supports illegal immigration. Says it's composed of rich people who desperately want someone to do their dirty work and do it cheaply. But listen to this. But immigration policy is only one example of the most serious problem with increasing economic inequality. The holders of great wealth, especially if they are organized into a political lobby of similar holders of great wealth, can buy not only more goods, more capital, and more people, they can also buy, through the vehicle of campaign contributions, more important people, politicians and other public officials, and therefore they can buy public policies. Having even more wealth than they had before, the very rich can then buy even more government supports and giveaways and acquire even more wealth, enabling them to buy even more government supports and giveaways, and so on. The result of great wealth, buying public policies, is a positive feedback loop, or perhaps a vicious cycle which transfers ever greater wealth and power to the very rich and away from everyone else. Mm-hmm. That's from the American Conservative. You'll hear that theme echoed in Moyers on Democracy, my new book. But the fact of the matter is, what can unite people on the left and people on the right is the realization that if we don't break the monopoly of money, we're going to lose our democracy.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. I'm interested in this. We talked about this some yesterday, and so I want you to talk about it. You write, the invitation was short and simple, a great deal of pleasure that I write to inform you. The superintendent of the U.S. Military Academy has approved the recommendation of the selection committee to invite you, Bill Moyers, as our speaker for the Saul Feinstein Lecture. So here you are, thinking about what to say to young men and women who within a year would be dying in another unnecessary war because their civilian leaders misled the country. That was quite a speaking engagement. What did you say?
And I was surprised to get it because, first of all, I had been in the Johnson administration, the early part of the administration, when the president escalated the war in Vietnam, a war that we lost and a war that has shaped our psychology and for a long time. Secondly, because of what I learned in the escalation of the Vietnam War, I was opposed to the Iraq War because they were repeating the same mistakes that the Johnson administration made in going to war in Vietnam. And they were sending, as we did, young men and women now to fight in a war that was unnecessary. The founders of our Constitution, of our country, wanted it to be very hard for presidents to take us to war, because they knew the consequences of what would happen. They would have been hung if the United States had lost, America, the colonies had lost the Revolutionary War. They made it hard. And here we were in a war that had no sense, made no sense. We were lied into it in Iraq. So I was surprised to get this note from West Point.
Yeah.
And I worked harder on that speech than anyone that I've done. And I'm so glad that Doubleday, the publisher, chose to include it in this book. I worked very hard. You have to spend time with it. And when I finished, there was 30 seconds of absolute silence in that big auditorium of cadets. And I thought, oh, Moyers, you have really blown this. And then they started standing up and they started speaking. Not because they agreed with me necessarily. I don't know whether they did or not. But because they appreciated the fact that somebody had come there and spoken the truth to them about what about politics and war. And then they kept me for 2 hours asking questions. I mean, these are bright people.
Goodness.
The day I arrived there, I asked to see the grave of Emily Perez. Emily Perez had just recently been killed in Iraq. She'd been a marvelous African-American young woman in Washington, leader in her church, singer in the spiritual group. And yet she wanted to do something for her country, and she wanted to signify. So she went into the military, went to West Point, and then she was killed soon after arriving. And they had just buried her at West Point just a few days before I got there. I went to her grave overlooking the Hudson River. And there, all the other graves, you know, are orderly and green. This one, having just recently been covered, was brown. There was no headstone yet, just a makeshift headstone. And I stood there thinking, and I told the cadets this. I stood there thinking, we must never, never send Emily Perez to her death unless it is clearly and unmistakably in our self-defense, unless it's to defend America. Preemptive presidential wars are an abomination to human dignity and sanctity and to the significance of democracy. And that, in a sense, that's what I said to the cadets. And they listened and they received it. And I hope some of them are still thinking about it.
Boyd from Milwaukee, our next caller. Hi, Boyd.
Hi, Kathleen. Good morning. And hello to you, Mr. Moyers. I heard you on Ashbrook the other night, and I thought you were great. You know, I like your message of hope, and I confess, I myself, and Kathleen, you may have known this too, I sort of take a much more pessimistic view toward the future, to the point where I really do wonder if the Union, maybe not in our lifetime, but I have two nephews and a niece in their lifetime, if it really can stay together. And I base my arguments by looking at history, a lot of it ancient, you know, ancient Roman Greece, but also American history following the Revolutionary period and the war between the states. And I'm wondering if in the fallout, if new governments that could be autocratic in nature could arise because of our sense of security. I hope I'm proven wrong. Your comments?
Civilization is a thin veneer of reason and civility stretched across the passions of the human heart. Civilization is something we will. It's not an act of nature, and it's very difficult to sustain. Look back over the long sweep of history, and you see that. The cities that have risen and fallen, the empires that have stretched around tens of thousands of miles and have disappeared. But Boyd, you know, I have five grandchildren. Their pictures are by my computer. Every morning when I get up, they are looking back at me, and they are the future. And I don't know how, I wouldn't know how to function in the world if I didn't wake up every morning expecting a more confident future for their interest, and then went out that day and did something to try to advance it. I mean, I couldn't live in the world. I'd probably become suicidal or depressive or a hermit. I just have to think when I get up, I can do something today, small though it may be, to realize a confident future. That I don't have any other response to you except to say each of us in our own way, wherever we are, whoever we are, has to do one thing every day that tries to advance the vision of a just country.
Well, that's a good way to look at every day. By golly, I like that idea. I must ask you about Jeremiah Wright. I know that you had him on your program, and then a couple days later he gave the inflammatory speech. Where did all of that figure? Who was he to you? What kind of man did you meet?
He was a stranger. I belonged to the same fellowship, the United Christian Church, the United Church of Christ, but our church on Long Island, was an independent, democratic, small D society like his is. I'd never heard of Jeremiah Wright, and suddenly this is all news, and he's in the news. And so I wanted to find out who he was. I invited him on the program for an hour's discussion on him, his life, his ministry, And it was a marvelous discussion. I mean, I ran out of time before I could get to all the questions, and I've been criticized for not asking him more tough questions. But I was more interested in this man who had been assassinated by sound bites.
Right.
I mean, this man spoke. He could have been a great scholar 36 years ago when he finished the University of Chicago. He chose to go into the south side of Chicago to a church that called him to be its pastor with 87 members and grow it to 6,000 mm-hmm. members. He had never sought a bigger stage. It was an act of history, putting Barack Obama in his church 20 years ago, that made him a player on the stage against his will. I think he's like the guy who goes out in the morning to pick up the paper, and a cyclone happens to hit it just that moment.
Mm.
And bang, he's thrust onto the national stage. But over 36 years, Kathleen, of preaching in the 11 o'clock service at Trinity United Church of Christ, he'd spoken 205,711 times. And for his whole life, in his whole career, his whole ministry to be reduced to 15 to 20 seconds,
right.
instantly, constantly recycled through the loop of the mega media grinder, was an injustice. So I wanted to give him a chance to be heard. Now, the difference between a reasonable man on Friday night on my broadcast
and the other man
and an angry
yeah.
man on Monday
yeah.
will require psychologists to deal with.
Bill Moyers, thank you so much. Thanks for your many years of wonderful work and for being with us. I enjoyed it.
Thank you, and good health to you.
Thank you. Bill Moyers, the book is On Democracy. It has just recently been published and filled with speeches that he's given over a long period of time, each one worth reading. Thanks to Carmen Jackson and Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and to Rhonda for on-air production and for your calls as well. We'll be with you tomorrow on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.